Go in the direction the bird is flying.
It's going back to the village.
Ignore the bird. Follow the river.
Move out.
Greetings and well met, travelers. You have found your way to Dragonreel, a magical journey to the realm of fantasy movies.
Welcome back to the Dragonreel podcast. This is episode 11, where we're going to be talking about Willow. And tonight I'll be your host, Chris, and playing with my wand always drives me up a tree. In chair number two tonight. She is kind of cute when she's quiet. It's Sharon.
Wait a minute. When I'm quiet?
Only when you're quiet.
We didn't want to tell you.
Oh my God.
Speaking of other chairs, in chair number three, one look at his chest and you can tell he was raised on Blackroot. It's Pete.
Wait, what? Oh, you know, yeah. No,
okay. It's true. Yeah, okay. Wait, no, I mean, how would I know? I don't know anything about Pete's chest.
God.
And joining us for the first time in this episode, without her, we dwell in darkness, introducing Summer Brooks.
Traitor child, I must despise you now.
Oh.
Welcome to the show, Summer.
Thank you. I am happy to be here, and this is actually one of the most fun movies I've ever seen, so I'm glad to talk about it.
Okay. Ooh,
great. Summer, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your movie experience? Or your movie watching experience?
My movie watching experience. Actually, I do have movie making experience. It was short and sweet, Ooh. But I enjoy science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Caveat, I enjoy old school horror, the psychological, dark investigations, the explorations of the dark side of the soul that take us over when we least expect it or are deeply hurt. And fantasy, so, sword and sorcery, can't go wrong there. And space opera. I really, really am a sucker for a good space opera, because to me, a space opera is like a Western, and I am really a sucker for a good Western.
Yeah. Babylon 5.
Oh, yeah. Talking 7 years about a show that was on air for five. We weren't obsessing about it at all, were we?
No, not at all. I loved every single episode. And I think I listened to your show at least twice. I think I've heard every episode twice. So, yeah.
So how many different podcasts do you have, Summer?
Used to be part of Dragon Page for a little while. My main stay was Slice of Sci-Fi and Babylon Podcast. Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas came and went due to some personnel, shall we say, tragedies. And so I'm currently working on, I was on the first season of Winging It, I think. Yeah, first season of Winging It. And then I'm doing Slice of Sci-Fi now as a 85% solo flight. I'm working on more ninjas, more Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas, and putting together a new show called Writers After Dark, where I delve into the appeal of story.
Wow.
Yes.
That's very meta.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. And so you chose to do Willow. Can you tell us a little bit about Willow?
Willow is an... It seems at first glance to be your typical fantasy, sorcery, sword and sorcery trope-ism. But there's a lot of heart in this movie. The story's about a small dwarf in this world called Nelwyns that are... Some are magic-based, most aren't. And they have their own little hobbit-ish type foibles in their community. And Willow is actually a young mage wannabe. He's got some talent, and he wants to be more than what the rest of his community sees him as. He ends up finding a human child, a Daikini baby, and he wants to help save this child. He wants to get this child back to where it belongs, because it deserves to live. And adventures ensue. He comes across, basically he becomes the center of his own traveling group of D&D characters, where you have the fighter, the evil fighter who becomes good, the mage, and the baby itself is the hope of the kingdom, the hope of the realm. And all of them end up taking on the evil queen. What actually happens to her is a question of a point of discussion that can be discussed later. But
sure,
basically, it's a quest with lots of magic, lots of romance, lots of
chase scenes.
For lack of a better word, shenanigans.
Shenanigans. I love that word.
Shenanigans and disguises and intrigue. Escapes. Double crossing, triple crossing.
Love.
Love and honor.
Romance.
And in the end, good triumphant over evil.
Okay.
Did we say disguises?
We did say disguises.
Oh, we did. Okay.
Oh, we did. There's a series of disguises that's absolutely hilarious to me.
So when we open.
Okay.
Chris and I were slightly confused. It seems like I thought I heard the voice of the evil queen at first in the room when the baby was being born.
You did?
And I did. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so she, so is it every child that's born, every girl child, or do they have to have a mark? I was just slightly confused. So she I know was, that you're the expert.
She was looking for a particular child with a particular mark. I don't know if that was an homage to the old Danny Kaye movie.
The Scarlet Pimpernel?
Oh, the Scarlet.
Not the Purple Pimpernel.
And I'm drawing a blank on that movie.
Yeah, Court Jester.
Court Jester, yes.
With the chalice from the palace.
Yes.
Right, the chalice from the palace and the dragon.
And the dragon from the flagon.
The flagon with the dragon.
The dragon with the flagon.
I think the dragon with the flagon broke.
It did make me think of that movie, right, but I wasn't sure if it was deliberate.
Like I said, I don't.
The vessel with the poison.
The fact that you know all of that is impressive and scary. But I don't know if that was an homage to that movie or if that just became such a common trope in fantasy movies that you identify the magical child or the hero, the hidden hero, by a mark, a birthmark or a brand. Because remember Beastmaster, he had the brand on his hand.
That's true.
Another one of my favorites.
That's on our list, but I haven't seen that in a couple decades, so I'll have to have a refresher
on
that.
Have to watch it, yeah.
One of my favorite all-time movies.
We'll bring it back for that one then.
Ooh. So yeah, she was looking for this particular child to be born, waiting for this child to be born. She saw the child born. She saw the prophesied mark on it and ordered it to be taken away and killed. The midwife
put it in the laundry basket.
The midwife could not handle that. She stole the baby, sent the baby off down the river, Moses-like.
Yes.
Where it ended up.
I liked that. I liked that.
Yeah, where it ended up in the realm of the Nelwyns.
Now, I have this. This is sort of a longer capture. Mm-hmm. But this is when the baby's born. And we were wondering at the end of the movie. So we were wondering, why doesn't she just kill the baby? But then we went back to the beginning of the movie and watched it again. And it was a setup that was supposed to be a ritual. So I have this.
Prophecy. This child will have no power over me. Start the ritual.
No! No!
Where's the baby? The midwife. Find that baby, Susha. Use the dogs. Bring her back to me alive.
Your reign of terror is at an end. She will come back and she will finish you.
Silence, wait.
My baby will finish you.
Kill her.
Did she just say to bring the baby back alive?
So that sets up the whole tension of the movie. That's the threat right there.
And she's very evil. Yes. I mean, clearly there's your villain because she's like, and kill her.
That actually explains why she just didn't kill the baby when it was born, when she identified it. She wanted to do a particular magic spell that would not only banish the child to a different realm where it could never hurt her, but I got the impression that she also wanted to either bind or steal whatever latent powers she had in order to be able to use them for herself. So she couldn't just kill the child.
And we know this ritual lasts at least 12 hours. So she can't be doing this to every baby girl that gets born in the kingdom.
No, no, no. She was
waiting. It's just impractical.
Right. No, she was just she identified the child by the mark. So if a girl child was born without the mark, she could care less. She was looking for this particular child. When she found it, that started everything in motion. And it's not like she was going to look for another child to be born with that mark. She already knew the one she was looking for had been born. She just had to go find it.
So,
I'll buy that for a dollar.
Different movie.
Very different. Different genre.
That's so a whole different podcast.
I thought it was very cute because, you know, kindergarten teacher. And I love scenes with little kids. Oh, I really like the scene when the kids find the baby.
As far as like 4-year-old actors go, they do an okay job.
They were so cute. Yeah. They
don't
were
go
so
near it.
Cute.
We don't know where it's been.
But Dad, it's a baby.
Put your lips on it.
Oh,
it's not like us.
No, it's not an Elwin. Looks like a Daikini baby.
Early on, they have different names for these. You know that these are races. Mm-hmm. It's not just a community of people who happen to have dwarfism. They are a different race of being.
Right. It's like the hobbits and the elves and the dwarves. It's just they gave them different names in this world.
A different name, yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe that was because it would be copyright infringement. Is there copyright infringement in movies? I don't know, but
I believe it was a marketing choice because they said, "Hey, you know, we can't market elf toys, but we can market Nelwyn toys and
Daikinis and brownies and
And Daikini sounded Japanese to me, so I looked up what that would break down to, and it broke down to, if you want to take it, you know, piece by piece, it breaks down to like up in the air or up in the clouds or something like that. Maybe to the Nelwyns, the Daikini means they're just way up there.
It could be their heads are in the clouds. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. So, but Nelwyn didn't have a Japanese root, so I threw that whole theory out the window. But Lucas has a lot of history with Japanese culture, with, you know, the Kurosawa movies, so it wouldn't surprise me if that's where he pulled that.
He named his first wizard Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Right.
Water sash, what was it, sword sash, water sash?
I'm not sure exactly how it translates.
How many people went out and watched Hidden Fortress after they found out he had based Star Wars off it?
Yep. Actually, I didn't watch that until much later when they had this huge Kurosawa retrospective at the movie theater I worked at. I got to watch that and Ron and a bunch of them, and I was like, wow, Kurosawa kicks ass. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw it years later as well. I mean, it's roughly close to when I heard that it was, you know, based on that. And I watched it, and I went, okay, I can kind of see it. And then, like, days went by, and I went, oh, the peasants are the droids!
Of course!
The beam of light shines through the crystal window. Yeah. Yeah. I liked all the scenes in Willow's village.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I like seeing the development of the family. I liked when he's like, I'm not going to fall in love with this child and stop feeding it and stop loving it. And,
if you know, keep touching it, the mother won't accept it anymore.
Stop it, Pete. You just know that, you know, he's this wonderful, loving dad, and he's going to totally love this baby. So I'm just sitting there going, yeah, how long is it going to take?
I guess
about 5 minutes.
It's got to be the panic dad through the whole thing. Like, no, don't do that. Early heart attack.
I got to say, this was probably the first movie that treated large amounts of little people with any amount of dignity.
Yes.
Because almost every time there was dwarfism represented in a movie, the condition itself was played for laughs.
True.
Oh, so you mean it was serious acting? Because I was thinking in the movie
it's not
itself.
That it was serious acting. It was that they treated them like individuals that weren't defined by this dwarfism.
Right. Well, yeah. Like they have a culture and they do things.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I liked that, but I was thinking in the movie itself, they keep calling them what, peck?
Well, there's going to be slurs.
Right.
Yeah, there's going to be slurs, but the way they portrayed the village and all the people in the village, it wasn't a monocultural thing. It was you had this group of people, like any other community. You had your good people, your average people,
your
asshole politicians.
You also
obviously had a class system. You had people who were much wealthier than others.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You even had warriors.
And they weren't relegated to, you know, repairing shoes and making cookies. So
exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. And when they all got together, you had something like this.
They had the electronic bass, which makes them much in advance of the Daikini.
So they had Blues Traveler come and play their Renaissance there.
Okay, so what is it about rustic villages and ale and parties?
Yeah.
You gotta celebrate sometime.
It's an unholy alliance, I tell you.
But wouldn't you want to step into that village? I would.
Totally. Sure.
And just have a couple beers or cider.
Slam a couple pints, you know, have a sandwich.
Be the tallest woman there, because like I'm only 5'2", so
I don't know. I've often been the tallest woman in places I've gone. Oh, wait.
What?
Never mind. Sorry.
We're already talking about dressing up?
Well, at least not this time.
Okay. But I really enjoyed the village scenes. And
they gave you quite a bit of Nelwyn culture.
Yes.
To start with.
And that sets up the, I guess, impending fish out of water scene where the Bav Morda's dogs kind of interrupt things. Bad dog.
And they're weird. They make this weird sound. So I captured a bit of the sound the dogs make. Mm-hmm. This is not a dog sound. Listen to this.
Well, I don't really think they're dogs. I think
they're kind of like rat hounds.
They're like rat dogs.
Yeah,
that were chasing the midwife.
Yeah, this is the problem I had with the dogs. The dogs looked like greyhounds that had, for lack of a better word, really, really bad Don King wigs on.
I was going to say Trekkian foreheads, but that works.
There you go.
Yeah, no, they were Don King. They were Don Kingish, and they were the dogs have the worst makeup ever.
Yes,
because they seem there was another movie where it seemed like the theme of the dogs had been, shall we say, liberally borrowed from. And I'm drawing a blank on the movie now, but the dog costumes were not well thought out. Mm-hmm. And that kind of disappointed me.
Well, there was, I think, a limitation on, you know, CG wasn't a thing in 1988. So there was a limitation on if you wanted something to move like a dog, there's only so much a dog will let you put on it.
Well, yes. I had a problem with the dogs too. And can I tell you what my problem was?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
They're scary.
That the queen, it's sort of a plot point. The queen wanted the baby alive. And it seemed to me that those dogs would shred anything. So I was a little confused that if she sent out the dogs, that baby wouldn't have been a baby for very long. It would have been in pieces.
No, because clearly they had adult Daikini blood taste. Or else they would have waded into the river and gotten her. Just as soon as they took down the nurse.
I think there was supposed to be the implication that tenders of the dogs were not far behind because the dogs were doing the tracking and the people were going to follow up and capture whoever the dogs cornered. That was my impression. But the only worse outfit I've seen were the RRUSs from Princess Bride. I mean, that was
just
my God.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yep.
Oh, my favorite movie ever. But then again, I don't know if I ever saw the ROUSs. I mean, I don't.
That was the same year as Willow, right?
I was 88 then.
I think it was maybe a year before. I'm not sure.
The year before, 87.
Okay. Yeah, we did that one, so I should know that.
Yeah. I don't know. I could have done completely without the dogs. I think if you would have taken out the dogs, it would have been fine.
Sure. According to IMDb, they were Rottweilers in rubber masks and suits.
Really?
So there's only so much a dog will let you do to it, especially
a Rottweiler. Yeah, I thought from the skinny legs that they were greyhounds. So that's my bad.
Oh, but that's interesting. That
I thought so too. That might have been part of the rubber suit, though.
Either way, the dogs were necessary because that's the inciting incident that quoting our high lord of storytelling, Joseph Campbell, that's what gets our hero started on his journey. The dogs threatening his home.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I can see that. And also for the woman that had the baby at first wouldn't have been running if she didn't hear the dogs. So You know, and see, and that's why we talk to each other, so that we can, you know, learn.
We all learn more. Today I learned.
Today I learned that the dogs were necessary in Willow. Yeah.
So it
yes,
becomes
children,
like...
you too can watch movies way, way too much and actually get something out of talking about them.
I find that hard to believe.
I love it. I love it.
So this is why this is what happens because the dogs raid the Ren family.
One beast we can kill, but there may be more. And you can be assured that they won't give up until they find what they're looking for.
It's a sign. Who's to blame for this?
We must find. I love that voice.
Right there, brainstorming.
Simpson.
Who's to blame?
I forgot about that. I
forgot my pills.
Who's to blame for this? Get off my lawn.
Oh my God.
Can you let me in? The wolves are after me. Oh, oh, oh.
So they kick him out. He has no choice but to go on this quest. Right. He's the only one that'll
kick him out. He basically grudgingly accepts after Billy Barty says, "Yeah, you know, have faith in yourself."
So this is a kind of a parallel to who's going to carry the ring.
Yes.
Yes. Only in this case, the ring is a baby.
Yeah, with the touch of Lucas in it. Because you must hide the child from the evil master, which is, you know, pretty much Star Wars.
Good thing the child didn't have a twin, huh?
Yes.
Yeah. Did I say that out loud?
So you don't really know what the baby's supposed to do. And you get the impression, because Willow was a standalone movie, it didn't turn into a trilogy. You get the impression from the end of Willow that that was the end of the queen. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So speaking of the touch of Lucas.
Yeah. No, I like I said, I have my own baby theory, but go. Okay. We'll talk about it later.
Oh. Do you have a smoking baby theory?
I got smoking.
Oh my
God. Aggressive old baby, perhaps?
We'll talk later.
Okay, we'll get to the end.
So, I actually like Mad Mardigan. Mm-hmm. And Chris and I almost, you know, broke up. I'm joking. We're a very happy couple. But
except when it comes to Val Kilmer.
Yeah. He doesn't like Val Kilmer. And I don't know why, because I thought he was really good in this part. I'm not entirely sure,
but I have had a lifelong hatred of Val Kilmer.
Wow.
And
I
think it started with this movie. Maybe it did. Maybe I am. I don't know.
Yeah.
He just seemed a little smug. And I think it just started with this, and I'm not sure.
But he's supposed to be smug. Wait, are you saying smug?
Yes,
smug as early as Real Genius.
He's supposed to be. I think he's supposed to be like Han Solo.
Yes, he's definitely a Han Solo in this. That's just another
touch. I think because Val Kilmer is not a Han Solo.
Mm. Okay, Summer, what do
you
think?
He's a Simon Templar, but he's not a Han Solo.
In this movie, he is supposed to be not really a Han Solo, but more of a combination of Han Solo and the stainless steel rat.
Okay.
I mean, he is a mercenary, mm-hmm. but he doesn't have. He's a gun for hire.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess in a way he'd be like Han Solo, but leaning more towards Shane. How's that? As for the smugness, yeah, he's been smug since Real Genius. I mean, Real Genius, I thought was a tour de force performance of his.
I gotta say, I've never seen that one.
What?
Oh, too bad. Classic.
Okay. Classic. Your geek card just got two dimensions.
Just got pulled.
Seriously, how can you've not seen Real Genius by now?
And he embodies smug as Iceman in Top Gun with the whole instead of replying to him, he chews the gum at him. He does the.
Right. I mean, that's intentional. That's it. That's totally intentional. And in this, he's playing the arrogant warrior. He's literally, oh my goodness, the steward's older son,
Boromir.
He's Boromir with
without all the arrows.
Right? No, without all the arrows at first. Yeah. But no, he's Boromir.
Man.
With an extra helping of arrogance and sloth.
Okay.
Arrogance and sloth.
Yeah. There's very, very little
He's almost like a Toshirô Mifune character in a lot of ways, where he's got the kind of Ronin.
Okay, you know. Now I can accept him.
Yeah, so. if you look at him.
Really? That's all I needed to say?
This was Toshirô Mifune?
You should have just looked at me and said, Rashomon. And I would have gone, no.
He's Yojimbo.
Right.
He's Yojimbo, yeah.
Right.
He's
totally Yojimbo.
Yeah. He's totally Yojimbo. Completely.
Yeah,
totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm down
so,
with that.
So, I mean, even down to the shenanigans with the sword.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, he's out for a little drinking and a little whoring and.
All right, you know what? You've convinced me that Val Kilmer is okay. I'm going to go watch Batman 3 now.
Why would you do that to yourself? Have some dignity. Good God.
Oh, my goodness. No.
Have a little pride. Okay.
So,
first meeting. Here's the introduction of Batman.
Give me some water, you measly little pecks. It's Daikini. We're in luck.
Pecks? Mm-hmm. Matt Morrigan's just a little bit racist.
I just thought it was funny. He's like, hey, there's a Daikini. It's the first one we found. Let's give him the baby.
Oh, that's great.
Run.
Even though he's sitting in a cage.
Yeah.
Clearly is a criminal of some sort.
Best part about that, though, is that you know he's not going anywhere while you discuss this.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I captured this, too, because it's...
Well, that was really stupid, Peck. Don't call me a Peck. Oh, I'm sorry. Peck, 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 peck. You be careful.
I just think, yeah.
I am a mighty sorcerer.
In a position to talk like that, by guy.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. No.
Yeah,
that entire scene cracks me up a little bit. Because, like, later on when the army marches by, he says, set me free, I'll win this war for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the first sense that he means it. He's
That's not just a con. It's not just a bragging moment. You know, like, oh, wait a minute, there's something special about this guy.
Yeah, that wasn't a ploy just to get out of it. It's like, set me free, I'll win this war for you. And the whole thing was, you don't serve any masters. I can't trust you. I know your skills, but I can't trust you.
Yeah, because he it's clear that he might turn on him, which also gives us some insight.
Or just go rogue.
Yeah, his character. Like, don't give him the baby. But you know, but his character, you know, like in any good movie, it develops and he changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the scenes with him. I don't know if it's too soon to say it, but with him and Saoirse. Oh my God, and Chris! But see, are you going to argue with me there too, Chris? That
I'm not going to argue with you. In fact, I think those two are the only characters in the movie that change at all.
Yeah, they have. All,
I mean, Willow.
Have any
Willow is like the you know the growth character, and he does you know become a little more sure of himself. But he was that way before. You know, he just needed more confidence.
Mm-hmm. He needed more confidence.
Ad Morgan and Saoirse change.
Yes.
Well, you know, Saoirse needed a heart and. No,
right.
But I also really enjoy listening to Saoirse's voice. Who is the actress that plays
Joanne
her?
Joanne Whalley. You know those two got married in real life after this, right?
So that's some really good chemistry when a blind person goes, wow, it's getting a little hot in here. And so
it's getting hot in here.
Mm-hmm.
So this was my favorite line by Mad Mardigan, and you may agree or disagree, but this is the keeper.
I feel better.
So I'm also reading on IMDb that he ad-libbed a lot of his lines.
Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a guy line. I don't know what I mean by that, but
what do you mean by that?
I don't know.
I'm not sure what you mean.
What do you mean, you people?
I don't really know what I mean by that. Yeah, you know, sometimes I just say things.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Val Kilmer was more of a method kind of actor, so he was like in the moment, in the character, and a lot of his ad libs, his impromptu moments, actually came from the character. So there were a lot of times where they used them. From what I understand.
Well, what about the scene where he dresses like the woman, like a woman, to get out of the
when they're hiding in the tavern in the inn, yes. And he's dressed up as the woman, and he's with someone else's wife,
Lug's wife,
and he dresses up and this is the whole double standard thing, you know. Lug puts forth the suggestion, which is literally my favorite line from the whole movie, going, "Wanna breed?"
Oh,
and that's one of the most impromptu, funniest things I've ever heard in that genre type movie. And the first time I heard it, I went, "Wait, what?" And I cracked
what?
Up.
Wait,
that's how I met Sharon.
That line cracked me up, and the response of tempting, but no,
tempting. Oh. So, did he even look like a woman?
Not even close.
Well, he was covering his face, and he had, I don't know what he had in his top.
Lipstick. He had lipstick on, he had some kind of blush on, and then he had two things in the
two massive gourds in his chest.
Yeah.
Hey.
What's really funny is that pink dress became his leggings for the rest of the movie.
Yes. Yeah. The costume was not, it wouldn't have fooled anyone.
Okay.
You get the feeling Lug might not be that discriminating.
Yeah. Lug sees, you know, melons up top and goes,
yep,
ooh.
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, okay.
So,
and then.
Wife didn't seem to be getting mad that he was just doing the thing that he was accusing her of.
Exactly. You know, double standard.
I guess
what is
she
this?
She was used to it. She was used that to his lechery, and maybe that's why she was being like that.
Mm hmm. And then the whole thing, you're not a woman. Not a woman? Not a woman? Gentlemen, meet Lug. And then bar fight. You got to love
which
it. When
is,
you
which
know,
is always the best distraction in fantasy.
Yeah,
if you get away
the distraction is the angry guy who starts the fight for you and takes out two or three of your opponents.
Sure.
So it's strategy.
It's a game called Let's You and Him Fight.
Mm-hmm. So I have to ask all of you, because I couldn't really see that much, well, obviously, in the chase scene. So how were the chase scenes?
Was it the whole movie a chase scene? I mean,
well,
not as much
were,
as Mad Max.
Well,
but
what I mean is
it's not even close to
chase,
Mad Max.
The chase scenes without talking. Mm-hmm. So when they're on the cart, what did you guys think? Was it visually stimulating? Was it visually exciting for you guys?
The scene on the cart, I'm going to say that Lucas and Howard lifted from Goonies.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I could see that, but I mean, honestly, one of the problems that I had when I rewatched this was I really feel it didn't hold up over time
chase,
for me.
The cart chase did get a little old after a while.
Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons was the cart chase.
Yeah.
It was a little too well. The suspension was a little too good on the cards.
Yes.
The suspension of disbelief does not hold up to the test of time, is what you're saying.
That and apparently their shock absorbers back then were fantastic. Right. Again, Nolan, not Daikini.
Because that was the problem in Goonies. You're on a cart on tracks, you know, literally the main difference. But you still have it defying laws of physics, gravity, reality, time dilation. And the cart chase. Yeah, like literally arrows
well, they,
are flying.
They borrowed that from Temple of Doom, so, you know.
Yeah. Arrows are flying. The only thing that was missing, I think, was the homage to the Western where you have the guy holding onto the horse's reins who's under the cart. So.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And they almost
they
went there
kind of
when he was trying to grab the reins.
Almost. Yeah, he.
I don't remember. Did they have the guy with his foot stuck in the stirrup?
No.
But Willow had to, Chris described that Willow, that the reins kind of fell underneath. He couldn't grab them anymore. Then he had to kind of lay down.
Yeah, on the crossbar.
Yeah, to pick them up and almost fell off.
Yeah,
that
would have been the Indiana Jones under under the truck or the good guy stagecoach driver underneath four horses who are it's like okay, I'm
so
sorry.
So what we're seeing is a lot of touches of Lucas here.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes, many.
So
Lucas ripping himself off.
Mm-hmm. Well,
pretty much, yeah.
And since Ron Howard directed this, I'm going to say, like, Ron, why didn't you just say George? No.
Mm-hmm. Dial it back a bit.
Honestly, I feel, and I've felt like this for a long time, that this was a much longer movie that got just axed.
Mm.
That there had to be just so much on the cutting room floor.
I would be curious to find out if there was a director's cut that had an extra 20 minutes to it.
Yeah.
I would.
But
you know what? I would
that,
actually.
I just felt they rushed that. They rushed that too. They really rushed that kind of thing. So.
Yeah. I actually would pay to see that extra footage if it still existed.
Mm-hmm. The stuff that I missed was, what is Sorsha's life like on a day-to-day basis with Sarah Kingdom as your mother?
It's mostly listen to your mom complain and then run off and kill somebody and then come back and hear your mom complain some more, like, and then run off and kill somebody else.
How could her mother not see her, like, turning her back when everything that we see her say is, like, just this nastiness?
Well, that's just it. We didn't actually see her start to change, to realize that her mother's way was wrong, until Mad Mardigan declared his love for her.
Yeah.
That was the first time anybody had ever showed any romantic interest in her as a woman at all.
Well, it strikes me that it might be the first time somebody's ever shown her positive emotion.
Quite likely.
Could be.
You know, most of the guys under her retinue are frightened of her.
My moon, my starlit sky. Without you, I dwell in darkness.
She spoke French.
What are you doing here?
Yeah,
believe it.
Before that, think about it. She interacted with the soldier. She was the captain of the castle guard.
She was one of the guys.
All of the guys were afraid of her because,
right,
A, she could kick their ass. B,
yes,
her mother could turn them into swine.
Mincemeat.
Yeah, there's so much. That does put a damper on a romance.
I loved that scene in the whole movie. I just... Maybe it's because I'm a romantic, but
no,
I loved that scene.
Yeah, that scene is special, but it was later, it was like, you dwell in darkness without me, and it went away?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, I'm sorry. So, yes. Actually, the two scenes together just make, and when they're fighting, and then they look back at each, and Chris described the whole thing to me, and I could really picture it in my head, so... Those two scenes were my two favorite in the whole movie.
Yeah, and when they got away and Willow's telling him what he did, he's like, I don't love her. She kicked me in the face.
Yeah, but it was very clearly, he's like, I don't love her, but he's thinking about it.
Yeah, he started thinking about it then when he realized, he's like, I did, really? Okay, well, no, maybe, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, the things that brownie dust causes to happen.
Yeah.
Well, and so, then that kind of begs the question.
I can't tell you how many years I would just every now and then just randomly go out beer, and like you'd hear somebody giggle because they knew what movie it was from. Yeah.
Well, what kills me is you've got two amazing stand-up comedians in Kevin Pollak and Rick Overton.
Were those the brownies?
Yeah,
they were the brownies. They were relegated to be the brownies.
I don't know what you're going to say, Pete, but I didn't like them at all.
That's
I know, and I know why. I know.
Two comedic powerhouses, and they do nothing with them.
Mm-hmm.
Summer,
For things like beer, you know, that's funny.
I was debating about this for days after I saw it. So why didn't I like it?
Why didn't they work?
Because for some reason, and I'm going to lay this theory at the feet of Ron Howard.
Okay.
I believe somewhere along the line, those two brownie characters, someone thought it would be funny if their dynamic was Lenny and Squiggy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's something that Chris said to me. And
I think that's Squiggy. No,
it's not. It's not Squiggy. It was not Squiggy, and it was definitely not Lenny, but
it was Kevin Pollak.
The dynamic was Lenny and Squiggy, even down to Kevin Pollak's doing the voice. I mean, all you have to do is close your eyes and you can hear him go, hello.
Hello.
Exactly.
Hello, Lillian. Hello,
I thought it was. I actually asked Chris to look up the actor because I thought it was Squiggy.
And then when you saw it was Kevin Pollak, you went, wait, what? So, somebody adding in, making those two play their dynamic like Lenny and Squiggy, I think was a misstep.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Here's your introduction.
Yeah.
Here's your introduction to brownies, right?
Okay.
I stole the baby! I stole the baby!
This question.
I don't know.
Why are they French?
I don't know.
Because you stupid canigots, they cannot sound like the Nolan nor the Dakini.
It's
not just that. I think a lot of it was they wanted a little more kid friendly. So they introduced the jesters.
Mm. Was this movie, does anybody know if it was marketed for kids?
It was not.
Okay, so
I disagree, because after this watch recently, I just sat there and I was like, "This is really tame."
I don't ever remember seeing any Willow related toys, so how could it have been marketed to children?
Oh no, I saw Willow mm-hmm. toys.
Really?
Oh really?
Oh yeah.
Are you sure?
I'm sure.
I would have bought a Mad Mardigan doll just for the sword.
You have brought this to the front of my brain. That
okay.
I think when I was sitting there watching it. There were parts that I liked very much, and there were parts where I'm like, this is stupid, like with the brownies and, you know, the chase scenes.
Oh my God. There is a Mad Mardigan figure. Sorry. Go.
Really?
Oh my God. You know, Summer's going to buy it now.
No, it's only $5. I've gone past that. I'm good.
Gone past that. Okay. So,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm saving my money for a Babylon 5 PPG. So
Oh my God, sister. Was it for kids? Because some of the characters, like the queen, she wasn't developed very much. And I thought, okay, so this would be a better movie for kids because, you know, kids need more of a clear cut.
Right. She's definitely a bad guy. There's no nuance to her.
So, but I wondered with the bar scene and some of the romance going on, like that didn't exactly seem like it would be for kids. So.
Mm-mm. When you compare it to the romance that was done in Princess Bride, it's completely for an older audience, especially with the innuendos.
Mm-hmm. No, I grant you that the innuendos are for the older audience, but I think that overall, even the kind of staccato timing of the bar scenes, you know, you don't see Mad Mardigan doing a boot zip, you know, or something like that. You see him, he's already... There's no reason for a younger audience to sit there and think of what he might have been doing, other than the fact that he's in a place he's not supposed to be, and now he's in disguise. I feel like it was targeted towards a slightly younger crowd.
Well, it was obviously marketed to a crowd that didn't buy movie tickets.
It was trying to do two different things at one time.
I agree, it was split.
That's probably what happened. That they didn't focus their marketing one way or the other, and they swung and they missed with both.
Yeah. I did have a question about the brownies.
Okay.
So one of them did this.
Lizards? Who are you calling lizards? Your mother was a lizard.
That made Kevin me Pollard. Think of Labyrinth. And do you know the one I'm talking about?
I do.
Yeah, when she's
when
in
this
the...
little thing popped up from under a pavement tile.
Your mother was a freaking aardvark.
You can hear him say that in Labyrinth. So I'm wondering if that character in Labyrinth was supposed to be the same race of brownies that this is.
Well, when was Labyrinth?
86, I think.
So Labyrinth was before Willow.
Yeah. And here's the thing about this movie. Everything in my memory, up until the time we rewatched Willow, I believed that this was in the early 80s.
Okay.
Which one?
I remember a Marvel Comics adaptation of Willow, which I read before I saw the movie, and I would have sworn I went to a particular drugstore and bought those comic books. I moved out of the town that the store I'm thinking of is in like 1983.
Well, clearly, Chris, I know what happened. It's because you traveled with the doctor, and when you went with him, what happened was because of the time vortex.
I took my 12-year-old to 1988.
Yeah, and what happened was the two movies became switched. Because in the first story, you were 12 when you saw it, but then when you went back in time, it was later.
No, you see what I'm saying? You're giving way, way too much credit to this. This is what happens when you have too many movies made by too many movie studios trying to copy off one another's even minor successes. They copy the same tropes over and over and over again. And because none of them really stand out, or few of them really stand out, the tropisms tend to blend.
Well, the thing that's most vivid in this memorized thing is the comic book. And I would have sworn this came out right about the same time as
this. No, see, I already explained this to you, Chris.
No, I get it. No, I just don't believe you. I think you're shit.
No, think about it. You did not mix up any scenes from Willow with any scenes from Princess Bride, did you?
No.
Quality.
There you go.
And it's my favorite movie. And
source material.
I will argue that Stardust is a better movie than Princess Bride, but that's fighting words for some people.
No, it's not fighting words for me, because
we actually rated them both very.
Yeah, it's up there, you know, like, and it's in there up there with my top three: Princess Bride, Stardust, Excalibur. I think are my top three.
And I was talking to somebody in a bar one time, and we talked about Stardust, and I said, you know what it reminds me of, and at the same time, we said Princess Bride. Mm-hmm.
Wait, so it wasn't. Wait.
Let's move on.
When were you in this bar?
I think Chris and I had that conversation.
Yeah, that was it.
You were in a bar. Okay.
In a bar. So, let's not even.
Where do we go? Okay, after the cart chase, where do we go?
Yes. Well, I think we were already in the tent. So we got past.
He met up with Eric again.
Yeah, he met up
there. It's a very small world in Willow World.
And you have to wonder who was. Where was the battle that Eric was coming away from? Because we know he was fighting Bavmorda's forces, but still, we should have had people running away from the area of this battle going, there's a battle over there, you might want to, you know, hike around the mountains.
Yeah, and the thing that when they met up again, the thing that it really highlighted to me was that all these villages are very small.
Mm-hmm.
There's like half a dozen people or half a dozen buildings in all of the villages that they encounter.
And yet both sides have thousands of soldiers.
Yes.
Really well armed.
Recruitment must be a bitch.
Well, there's a city somewhere we haven't seen yet.
Yeah.
Which technically would be that one castle we get to later.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah. So they met the female brownie. Like, I guess she was the queen.
No, she wasn't a brownie. She was a fairy.
She was a cursed. Oh, wait. Are we talking about the cursed
sorceress?
We're not
talking about Roselia.
No, not Roselia, but the I think she was a glowing ball.
The one that
she
was
Tinkerbell.
Yeah.
Just get it out. She was Tinkerbell. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was asking Chris if it was Glenda, if she looked like Glenda.
No, really? Tinkerbell.
No.
More Tinkerbell.
Okay, Tinkerbell.
Okay. So then she tells them to, she tells Willow to go and find Grizel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does she give him something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the wand.
The wand. Mm-hmm. And she gives him the wand.
Says, this is a magic wand.
Oh, and that's how he ends up in a tree.
Woo-hoo! Yes. So speaking of magic, the Billy Barty gave him magic acorns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how come he doesn't use them?
He uses one accidentally and turns a plank of wood into stone, which then breaks and they fall through.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And he throws the other one at Bavmorda at the end of the movie and it doesn't hurt her. So these acorns were worthless.
No, it did hurt her, but her magic was more powerful.
Right. So it would have been nice if he had actually used one.
In the battle?
In the movie.
With the trolls?
At any point.
He tried to use one with Bavmorda.
Yeah.
So I'll give him that. Using them with the Hydra, the trolls turning into the Hydra thingy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was kind of weird.
You know, or the soldiers.
Well, no, turning one soldier into stone, that wouldn't have stopped the others. So
why did the troll turn into a Hydra?
I'm going to go with
mystic
perfect contamination magic. of the moat.
No, because it started to sprout heads before it hit the moat.
Right, but it grew really, really fast after it was kicked into the moat.
I want to know why, considering all the magic that was here, nobody could fix General Kael's forehead.
So that was another thing that just seemed like a gratuitous touch of Lucas, the guy with the Darth Vader mask.
Uh-huh.
So the Griselda, right? Am I saying it right?
The Griselda.
Finn Razzell.
Griselda.
No. There's no duh.
No. Finn Razzell. Two words.
Finn Razzell. Okay. Yes. So when she Griselda. When she was morphing, mm-hmm. how did that look too?
The CGI that on that I thought was pretty cool because you started out with what was it? A lemur?
Some kind of tree marsupial primate.
Yeah, a lemur or a marmot or something yeah, cute and fuzzy that. With a long tail and big bug eyes.
You know what? I bet trivia knows.
Anyway, it was very squirrel like and had big lemur bug eyes, but it wasn't a lemur, and it morphed into several animals, including a tiger, before actually morphing into an elderly human woman. And for the year that sort of digital transmogrification was popular, it was pretty good for the time.
It was pretty good.
Okay. It looks dated
IMDb
now.
Is saying this is the first feature film that used morphing.
No,
is it?
Krull.
No. There's a classic for you.
Krull is the first movie to use morphing.
But yeah, no, for the time, the transitions, because they actually paused in between some of the transitions, because there was one point where she had tiger paws, but the head of a different animal. So it was, you saw it in between each transition. It wasn't like a fast transition to each one. Sometimes it was a slow morph or a fast morph, depending on how much effort Willow was putting into the spell. I thought
it
that
says
was
she's
well
a brush-tailed possum, by the way.
Brush-tailed possum. Never heard of that one.
Nor did I. Which seems like an odd choice for Bev Morta to turn her into.
I'm going to guess that animal is native to Australia or New Zealand.
Where they filmed?
Uh-huh.
I didn't know it was filmed there. No, that's interesting.
Yeah, they used a couple of bad matte paintings a couple times, but, you know, you got the point.
So I noticed something about Saoirse. I love, like I told you, I love the scenes with her and Mad Mardigan, but they didn't have her speak. Like after they sort of established the relationship between the two of them, she didn't really say anything at the end.
Right. She did help in the fight, and you know her mom almost threw her into a wall of spikes, mm-hmm. which was kind of a bitch move. But you know whatever.
Right. Yeah. I don't even care about
like that
daughter.
Is super bad parenting.
Yeah. I mean that's the whole line from when they were encamped outside the castle. You know, traitor child. I must mm-hmm. despise you now.
Now, yeah. But I would have liked... I think I would have liked it if Saoirse could have said, you know, something. Like, I don't know, just some kind of line to her.
She was a strong character until they turned her.
No, she did. She yelled when she started turning everybody into pigs. She yelled, "Mother, stop." But then she didn't say anything after that.
Yeah.
Right.
And then they kind of like softened her up for the final scene where, of course, the woman's holding the baby now.
Started on that one.
So are we going to talk about the books?
Why would we want to ruin a pretty little conversation?
Oh.
Did you read them?
Did we lose her?
I'm here. I put myself on mute so you wouldn't hear me typing furiously going, "There was a book?"
Okay. So apparently they wanted to turn it into a series, a franchise, but it didn't sell enough. So Lucas licensed the books and Chris Claremont wrote novels.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And apparently they stink.
Yeah, they
The first one isn't bad. It's just that as Willow turns into this dark sorcerer.
And the baby grows up to be a spoiled brat. Which
so everything you
I don't
like about Willow is ruined by the books, apparently.
Pretty much, yeah, because they gave it to Chris Claremont. But I mean,
I have my own issues with Claremont and what he did with Phoenix and the X-Men. Same. So yeah, Jean Grey Phoenix.
Okay. We're having a great talk. Why do we have to spoil this by talking about Chris Claremont?
Were three Willow novels that I never knew about, so my life is probably better for never having read those.
Apparently.
Yeah, our friend Jim, who loves fantasy, said they're quite horrible and very depressing.
Yeah, read the reviews on Amazon. They are really, really, like, everybody says, if you liked Willow, you'll hate these.
Yeah, don't read the books. So, Chris, you have to ask me if I like the music in this movie.
What do you think of the music, Sharon?
I really liked the music.
I'm glad to hear it.
I thought the music was really nice in this.
This was one of the James Horner ones, right?
I will completely fess up and say the music did not stand out to me.
Mm. Me either, honestly. Oh. Except for the fact that there was, you know, an electronic bass in the Netherlands music group.
No, okay, I'm going to throw this out there since are we done talking about the whole plot? I'll save that for. But no, we have to talk about the end battle in the castle.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, let's do it.
All right, the ritual, which for some reason Bav Morda had to dress up as a mummy to perform.
Mum-ra.
the ritual I thought was very intricate, very detailed, and I thought that it was appropriate that even though we saw Willow's confidence and magical abilities growing, he resorted to a basic stage illusion to freak her out and literally sidetrack her. She was waiting for some sort of real magic power, and all of a sudden, poof. No, I sent her someplace you can't find her. What? Poof.
That's fantastic. Yep. That was... yeah.
So, Summer, are you saying you liked that, or you didn't care for that?
No,
you
I liked how
that was a great touch.
They brought that back in, because that's what he was at the beginning. He was doing stage magic, and he knew he didn't have the power to counter anything she threw at him. So he went with a basic illusion that she had no experience with, no counter for, no possible way to even see through it.
And you know, plus, Chekhov said, Chekhov said, if you put a conjuration trick in the first act.
Oh, right. Chekhov's prestige.
Chekhov's prestige.
And exactly. if you look at the nice, Chekhov's magic wand on the mantelpiece.
Nice. Right. Oh, there it is.
And if you look at the reactions of the other characters, even Finn Rizal panics. She's like, she can't figure out. It's like, what kind of magic is this? What is she?
You did what?
And it's like, where's the baby? And he goes, it's just my disappearing pig trick. And you know, even the good magician was fooled. So, bravo. Yeah. Storytelling kudos there.
Yes, I'll go along with that.
Even with the jazz hands at the end.
Cutting the baby in half was a bit much, though.
The party, this is why the music never stood out to me. The Nelwyn's party music was too much like the Ewoks party music.
Good point.
That's where even when they're playing it at the end, as everybody's all happy and celebrating, I'm like, really? We went with Ewoks? George, please let it go.
So apparently Warwick Davis was 13 when he did Return of the Jedi.
Yes, he was.
And so he was 18 in this. So here he is, 18 years old. He's got a family. He's got two kids to support.
and this much larger child who's going to eat far more and far more. It's coming into his life. No wonder he panics the whole time.
I thought he would. He did well in this movie, but I thought he was a bit inexperienced for carrying the whole film.
Yes.
He was inexperienced to play Willow?
Yeah, I thought there were a couple times
where he was only a teenager, because he played the main Ewok.
Wicket,
right.
See, I liked him.
They were asking a bit much for him to carry an entire film.
Hmm. And not just that, but a lot of times they make him very Frankenstein whiny. You know, he's very whiny about the situation that not a lot of people can do a whole lot about. But he's like the one like, no, don't do that. No, that was wrong.
Yeah.
You're a bad person, you know, kind
of
thing.
If he had had maybe 5 or 10 more years of acting experience, this probably would have been a better performance for him.
Okay.
Stronger, definitely.
I don't know if I agree with that, but sometimes I just like to disagree with you guys.
That's true.
I don't know. I get when I talked about the music, Chris just usually asks me, you know, because I can't see, he'll say, well, how is the music? And I'm like, yeah, it fits, you know, it fits what they're doing. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was like phenomenal, but I thought that it seemed to me to match what was going on in the story, because sometimes when you're just getting the sound part of the movie, I tend to hyper focus a little bit on the music, and I'm like, you know, yeah, that's setting the mood for this or that. So now I want to watch Star Wars to listen to the music with the Ewoks and see if it's similar, because I guess I just wasn't thinking too much about that. I was trying to.
It's not similar in when if you're breaking it down musically, but the tone with the party atmosphere, with you have the little rustic community of small people partying, and all is good in the universe. There's rainbows and red clouds and puppies
and
X-wing fighters and.
Yeah.
And beer!
Yeah.
Beer!
This score pulled from too many other obvious places.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was a collection of tropes that had already been played in other movies.
It could have had more originality to it, but I liked it. So Sharon.
Yes.
On a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate Willow?
I am going to give Willow 3.5 gold pieces.
Right. You want.
Because I'm comparing it to a movie like Princess Bride.
Okay.
Which I gave 5.
5 too, yeah.
So, and Stardust, which I gave 5 gold pieces to.
All right. Pete, on a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate Willow?
I'm going to go 2.5.
Whoa.
I'm going to go 2 gold pieces and 5 silver.
Hmm.
Mostly because I don't feel it held up very well. I thought that the story needed to be fleshed out more. The dogs really kind of killed it for me. Yeah, I just felt like I said, I feel like the last, especially half an hour of the film, is phenomenally rushed.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, and the fact that they didn't use Rick Overton and Kevin Pollak to any good performance.
Yeah. Okay. Summer, on a scale of 1 to 5 gold pieces, how do you rate Willow?
I'm going to give Willow a solid 3.
All right. Any comment?
I liked how the story seemed to just treat magic as part of the world. How you had the different races, but you know that those were pulled from other stories that were well told. But it, you know, as far as execution, the execution on a substandard story is still well done.
Awesome,
Christopher. Yeah, on a scale from one to five gold pieces.
Yes.
How do you rate this movie?
You know, I'm going to give Willow a shaky 3.
Okay.
The same
He's
reasons.
He's going to give it 2 gold, 9 silver.
Two gold, nine silver, 9 copper. no, but it does well enough to rate that 3. I think one thing it has that some of these other things don't have is there's joy in this movie.
There is joy.
Yeah.
There definitely is joy, and it's
an enjoyable watch.
And there was sex appeal. Those couple scenes that I mentioned earlier. So
I can't remember what I rated Reign of Fire, but it was on a shaky ground too, but it had no joy in it.
No.
And this movie, had enough joy to bump me up from a 2 to a 3, you know, in spite of the brownies.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So that's my rating.
That's funny because usually I enjoy some good brownies after a movie.
Oh my gosh. And what's our next movie? Is it
our next movie is going to be Sharon's Choice Excalibur.
Yes!
Ooh.
I'm so excited.
Wait
oh
a second. Who chose Willow?
Oh, did you want to
Summer
pick
chose
it?
Willow.
I did.
So who chose the one before it?
I did.
Reign of Fire.
You did. Reign of Fire.
Okay. All right, good. Okay.
Yeah. I thought you loved Excalibur though, Pete.
I love Excalibur, don't get me wrong.
Okay.
I think it's probably, if not the best, the second best of John Borman's films.
And here I say, who?
Far cry above Zardos.
Oh my God.
Oh!
Zardos.
Which is also directed by John Borman. So.
I did not know that.
Yes.
So we should ask Summer. Summer, if people would like to get a hold of you, how can they get a hold of you?
The most reliable place to get a hold of me is Slice of Sci-Fi. But yeah, sliceofscifi.com. There's my email address is out there, summer@sliceofscifi.com. There's comments you can leave on the website. You can send in the contact form. You can even record your own voicemail message and send that in to me.
Excellent.
And Chris, how can people get a hold of you?
People can find us on dragonreel.com. We are also on Stitcher, and we are on Twitter at twitter.com/dragonreel. Pete, if one wanted to email the Dragon Reel podcast, how would they do such a thing?
They would do so at dragonreelpodcast@gmail.com.
You're a good man, Pete.
Thank you.
Sharon?
Yes.
Tell us about how people can get a hold of you.
people can check out Teaching with Sight at blogspot.com. And I just was interviewed by Channel 9 because I just put up a project on Donors Choose to try and raise money for multicultural gingerbread stories.
Sounds like a worthy cause.
It is, because I teach at a Title I school and we don't have enough money to buy gingerbread books for the whole kindergarten team. And my kids are so beautiful and they love stories.
One donates to such a project.
They would just go to donorschoose.org and they would look up multicultural gingerbread stories.
Okay.
And even $5 would be a great donation.
Yeah. Do they eat the gingerbread books when they're done, or are they not edible?
I'm sorry. So there's stories. There are multicultural stories from around the world. So they're kind of like the gingerbread man, but there's a runaway rice cake that kind of will give them insight into Chinese culture, and there's the masabi man, which takes place in Hawaii. So, and there's the gingerbread girl who doesn't get eaten, by the way. And my girls just always said, how come there's only a gingerbread boy? And I said, actually, there's a gingerbread girl story. And she's smarter than her brother.
There you go. Yeah. I still think a gingerbread book is kind of cool.
All right. And if you're really into gingerbread, you can go to drivethroughrpg.com and look for gingerbread kaiju. So that will do it for the Dragon Reel podcast this time. Join us next time for Excalibur. Thank you, Summer, for joining us this time.
Thank you, Summer.
We hope to have you back if you're willing to.
Just have to ask.
That was episode 11. Join us next time. And until then, have fun storming
the castle.